Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown, out on the edge of the prairie. It was the end of school on Wednesday, and it was high school graduation on Thursday evening, so major events in our town. It's been cool and breezy there, but we're in the midst of a drought. We haven't had rain much at all in the month of May, and so people are letting their grass grow long so it'll stay green without the need for watering, which some people like. Some people like this kind of shaggy look of the yard, and other people prefer a groomed look. It's an old argument between natural and civilized. I stand with civilized myself. I love cities. The beautiful thing about going to the country is that you can come back to the city. That's how I look at things, and I stand by that. If my little girl wanted desperately to go camping, I would, of course, take her camping, and I would sleep on the ground and in a sleeping bag, and I would cook over a campfire. But she has not indicated a desire to do this. Thanks to all I've taught her about poisonous snakes and spiders and rabid bats flying in the dark. So that's the story on that. It was Pentecost Sunday this last week in the Lutheran Church, where by tradition you wear red, and it's an unfortunate tradition, because it leads to some women appointing themselves as Pentecost monitors. And they like to walk up to people during the coffee hour and say, "So, are you wearing red for Pentecost?" And here they are in a bright red dress that would stop traffic on the freeway. And they're talking to somebody who they can see wears no red whatsoever, except for a few veins in their nose. And some wine spills on their pants. It's detestable. Monitors of the faith. Judy Inkvist, the pastor's wife, detests this so much that she refuses to wear any red. And when one of the monitors walks up and says, "So are you wearing red for Pentecost?" She says, "Yes, but you can't see it." And she purses her lips, sort of like Marilyn Monroe did in those pictures. The whole meaning of Pentecost is that the church is an extension of the divine. It's not just a club of people who follow certain roles and who all believe the same things. This is actually God's muscle on earth. We're here to do God's work, which is a sobering thought, a very sobering thought. And there are many sobering thoughts as you get older, the idea that there are things that need to be done that will not be done unless you do them. This occurs to you as you get older. And also, of course, you see yourself coming closer to the cliff. It's out there in the mist, and the young people are pushing against your back. And you have no idea where the edge is. A lot of sobering thoughts as you get older. And we are Lutherans. We're sober to start with. So we tend to be a little sour even sometimes. We envy people who can whoop it up, young people who can whoop it up. End of school on Wednesday, 10 minutes before the end of class, they released the seniors so the seniors could run through the hallway leaping and skipping and whooping and screaming, and boys taking off their shirts and waving them over their heads. You could hear it all over town, and we just envied that ability to let go. We haven't been able to let go in a long time. The biblical command to be joyful is one we've been ignoring since we were children. The Kruger boy who plays in the town band. Here's a kid who plays the worst clarinet, and he has such a wonderful time doing it. He sits there and grins, the brass, the trombones, the saxophone, the accordions, the marimba. They're doing this kind of a straightforward version of Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean. And here's this clarinet wildly skittering around. Every so often it touches a note, and it just has a wonderful time. And when they come to the end of it and Mrs. Hoagland signals for them all to stand up, he jumps up before anybody else, big grin on his face. It's like Yeats said, the worst are full of passionate intensity. The best lack all conviction, but the worst are full of passionate intensity. Pastor Enquist sits in his office in church and he thinks about these things. This is the time of year when young couples come to him for counseling for the fall wedding. The fall wedding is now very popular, more popular than the spring wedding, and they need to come to talk to the pastor if they want to get married in the church with the organ and the stained glass and the guy in the vestments. They have to come and talk to him. And so they do. He's as nice as he can be. But he has, after all these years, a very clear sense, talking to young people, which ones won't make it. They're doomed. And he knows it. And here they are, and they're full of love and lust and affection for each other. And they believe that love conquers everything. But love doesn't conquer everything any more than love cleans the toilet or love makes the bed. It just doesn't do all of that. And he can tell they're doomed. They're not going to make it. Here they are in all sincerity and with great enthusiasm. They are laying the foundation for years of bitter misery. And perhaps they will bring a child into the world and then it will all fall apart around them. And he wants to tell them, don't do this. This isn't going to work out for you. But he doesn't dare, because to tell them that would only make them more determined. So he sits there and he watches people heading towards the cliff, joyfully holding hands, singing, walking towards the cliff of regret. We worry about our kids at this time of year. This is the period of grace for our 18-year-olds who've just graduated, and we don't push them too hard right now. We give them a few weeks to be kids again. You can hear the teenagers out in the playground after dark. They're going down the slides. They're swinging on the swings the way they did when they were kids. You hear them inner tubing on the river, and they're singing and they're laughing. They're running through meadows and the woods. We can hear them laughing in the backyard. We grant them this period of grace, although we worry about them. We wonder, what if they don't ever get jobs? They don't have jobs now. What's going to happen if they don't? Our beloved child becomes a case study, and teams of therapists and psychologists are brought in, and scholarly articles are written about your child, about this seemingly normal, happy 18-year-old who suddenly just became inert matter and never did anything more. We're worried about them at the same time as we grant them this period of freedom, this period of grace in the world to laugh and have a good time. Unlike us, they're Lutheran parents who are burdened down by all the weight of the world. It was a good graduation Thursday night. It was in the football field. It took about 2 hours. The main speaker was some alumnus who had done something in finance. I never heard what, nor cared, he spoke for about 20 minutes about the importance of communication as he was demonstrating how not to do it. It was one of those self-erasing speeches, you know, that you come to the end of it and you clap and you can't remember what this was about. If this was about communication or communism or the state of Connecticut or what it was. And then the procession of graduates in their blue gowns with the gold trim coming across, the little pinpricks of flash cameras from all over taking their pictures. They came across the stage and got their diplomas. Mr. Halverson did not give out diplomas this year. He had fainted around the beginning of the graduation exercise. He sat down feeling a little bit woozy. He's very anxious when it comes to graduation, knowing of this long tradition of seniors and their practical jokes that they play on the superintendent, and sometimes involving explosives and sometimes involving a podium that rolls away from you and little plastic hoses of water aimed at a very bad place. And so anxious, he fainted. He fainted just a few minutes after he had drunk a glass of water that one of the senior boys brought to him. He just sort of folded up and collapsed. And then six of the senior boys came right away to his aid, and they lifted up his limp body. And they took him off to the groundskeeper's shack, which is down at the end of the football field, down beyond the goalposts. And they took him in there, and they were in there with him for a while. And then one of them came out and said, he's okay. There's no need to call an ambulance or anything. He woke up about half an hour later, and he was naked. He was lying on some bags of fertilizer, and his clothes were gone. And there was no tarp or canvas or fabric of any kind to cover himself, except for an American flag. And so he wrapped it around himself, and he slipped out the door. And one of the seniors was talking and giving a speech, and the crowd was very quiet and attentive, and talking about how much school had meant to him. And could we all stand and sing the alma mater? And just then a spotlight hit Mr. Halverson as he was sort of rearranging the flag around himself. And there he was, caught in bright light as they sang, "Hail to thee, our alma mater. Oh, that we could longer dwell here in thy hallowed hallways. But we bid farewell. All through life the dark voyages, long the coasts of grief and fear. Oh, we will always remember how you loved and taught us here." There he stood, pinned in the spotlight. And their hearts went out to him. He looked like a fugitive refugee, which is who they are, really. They're in flight. They're in flight from us. We are so boring, they can't wait to get away from us. They're trying to escape from us. That's how we know they will find jobs, because they look at Mr. Torvaldsen driving down in his big boat of a car down to the Chatterbox Cafe, 8 o'clock every morning for breakfast. Always complains about the coffee. Always comes down for lunch at 12 noon. Goes back home, back to his home with the car, with the plywood cutouts of big fat people bending over and the plywood bear climbing up in a tree and the cast iron deer and all of it. And then comes back for supper at 6 o'clock. They see Torvaldsenism and they can't wait to get away from us. They don't want to wind up like that. A choice between restless uncertainty and pleasant monotony. They make the choice for restlessness and uncertainty. And so, looking at Mr. Torvaldsen and his regular habits, he's like the tide. They run away as fast as they can. They go off to big cities. They make unwise marriages. They go terrible career paths. They make all sorts of mistakes just to avoid his life. They go off and they live lonely lives in big cities, trying to meet people through Craigslist and sit in a coffee shop in a strange city with a stranger, making small talk, painful small talk, for half an hour or 45 minutes with long, uncomfortable silences, and then the painful goodbye at the end of it. Well, it's nice to meet you. Yeah, it was really interesting to meet you. We should get together again. Yeah, we should get together. I'm sort of busy for the next week or two, actually leaving town for a month, but after that, yeah, let's, yeah. They go off to lead strange lives in big cities like Los Angeles just to get away from us, get away from us and the Midwest. Their choice, their choice. We wish them well on these summer nights in Lake Wobegon, the honeysuckle, smell of it all through town, the lilacs, the green grass, the sound of water sprinklers in the evening. We wish them all well, walking around town, young people, young lovers, holding hands, grabbing onto each other, and they just have to touch each other all the time. Email does not work for this. A chat box does not work. Facebook does not work. They want to hold onto each other. They want to bury my face in your neck and smell your hair and hold your hand to my heart. It's a treacherous world out there. So treacherous. Cliffs everywhere. Danger everywhere. But we brave it. We brave it if we can be with the one we love and hang on. Hang on tight. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, all the children are above average.